where you have fluidity in sleep practices, women get, and or people who need more sleep are able to do so because there isn't a bedtime. There isn't a sense of, now you have to go to sleep, or you must stay up until a certain time. So I think that that lack of notion of how much sleep you must get and when you must go to bed creates some space for taking the edge off some of these inequalities, or also labor issues that have some members of society needing more sleep or sleep at different times than other members.
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily Giles.
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is the Untaming podcast. Today, it is the last quarter of the worm moon here in the Southern Hemisphere. I really hope you enjoyed the last episode with Dr. Oskar Seralek as much as I did. In the next episode, I will chat with Erica Butler about sex positivity. But today, we have Mary back again, interviewing Dr. Carol Werthmann. This one, as with many of Mary's interviews, really validates how crucial co-sleeping is for babies and children.
Hi everyone, this is Mary Francell, IBCLC. I'm your occasional guest host here on the Untaming podcast. I live in Bellingham, Washington, in the United States, the northwest corner of the U.S. And I also am very interested in biology as relating to parenting and infancy. And so I write a blog called What Babies Need, and you can find it at www.whatdobabiesneed.com. And today I am so pleased to interview Carol Werthmann, who is a professor emerita at Emory University. She earned her PhD from Harvard University and currently serves as professor emerita in the Department of Anthropology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, in the U.S. Dr. Werthmann integrates anthropology, human development, and neuroscience to investigate the basis of differential well-being with biocultural and biosocial research in 13 countries, including Kenya, Tibet, Nepal, Egypt, Japan, Papua New Guinea, Vietnam, and South Africa, as well as in rural, urban, and semi-urban areas of the United States. In 2020, she received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Human Biology Association, and in 2021, she received the Society for Psychological Anthropology's Lifetime Achievement Award. Last night, she got 7 hours of sleep, and for lunch today, she had a piece of cheese and some greens. So thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Werthmann. I'm so pleased to have you here. We're thrilled to hear more about your research. Carol, if you could please tell me how you first became interested in anthropology, I'd really appreciate that.
Oh, well, this was in my senior year of college, and I was firmly on a pre-med track, interested in doing an MD, PhD targeting cancer. And at that time, everybody wanted to be a doctor, and this was Pomona College, very pre-med oriented. Everybody wanted to be a doctor, and cancer was the big deal. But I had to take one last social science requirement, and I looked in the catalog, and anthropology looked interesting, and I was absolutely blown away by the number of questions and issues that anthropology took on that I felt really were not informing, like areas of cancer research or other things that you would think that anthropology would relate to. So when I compared the density of talent that was going into medicine and cancer relative to anthropology, it looked like I could have something to contribute in anthropology much more And so that's where I went to my parents' work.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. And I know you focused your research in a number of different areas, but I know you have some research that you've done in sleep, and I'd love to find what kind of drew you to that area in particular.
Mm. Yeah, it was the same sort of serendipitous moment where I was part of a research network on the developmental psychobiology of stress. And one of the members was a pediatric psychiatrist who had emphasized that sleep problems often anticipate mental health issues. And so he called me up one day and said, you know, hey, Carol, you know, you're the anthropologist. You should be able to tell us about how people usually sleep. And, you know, is that different from how we sleep now? And I was stunned because the answer was nothing. I mean, we knew about sleep practices vis-a-vis infant care and co-sleeping taboos, incest taboos, things like that. But in terms of how much or where and how people slept, there was really very little, in spite of the fact that at least 20 years of research at that time had intensely and quantitatively studied every aspect of what people did when they were awake. So a third of people's lives was left out, and I felt compelled to take that on.
Absolutely. Definitely a need there for sure. So I'd like to read a wonderful quote that I just love from one of your articles and have you comment on it. It starts specifically in Western culture, and I put that in parentheses, in Western culture. Specifically in Western culture, patterns of solitary sleep on heavily cushioned substrates consolidated in a single daily time block and housed in a roofed and solidly walled space contrast with the variety of sleep conditions among traditional societies. These conditions include multiple and multi-age sleeping partners, frequent proximity of animals, embeddedness of sleep in ongoing social interaction, fluid bedtimes and wake times, use of nighttime for ritual, sociality, and information exchange, and relatively exposed sleeping locations that require fire maintenance and sustained vigilance. Now, I think most of our listeners are quite familiar with standard Western sleep setups, at least those folks that live in more privileged communities. So can you expand upon this quote and give some examples of how people may sleep in more traditional societies?
Sure. Well, first I should tell you how we got the evidence, since I just told you we didn't know anything. How would I get the answers to what you were just quoting about? And what we did was, although anthropologists had not addressed questions of sleep, many of them live and work in societies for extended periods. So I recruited 8 of my buddies to give ideas about and recollections about how people slept, where they slept, what factors might influence sleep. And because they had worked in these societies for a long time, they were willing to at least give a expert view of these questions. We took an ecological perspective because we couldn't be quantitative, how much do people sleep? But we could ask questions about where, how, about when, with whom, all those sorts of things people would sleep, and then what factors are shaping sleep practices. So we, because some of these folks work in more than one society, we wound up with 12 societies that we had investigated. And yeah, that quote reflects my astonishment. Because as usual in anthropology, you think you know what humans do, but when you explore the diversity, you find out there's a lot of stuff we don't know. And so one of the chief things that people may be surprised by, I kind of was no bedtimes. So I was used to the idea of bedtime. It's like, I understand there are no clocks there. But still, there must be something about bedtime. But really, sleep is not as separated from the ongoing run of daily life, and especially little kids, but just whoever sleep when they need to or want to. Sometimes they just crawl up in a corner, or they just fall asleep on the mat right in the middle of everybody else, or they go off and sleep somewhere else. But the notion of bedtimes was really absent. So that was one thing. And then another thing was the whole notion of bed. I began to view my bed as a giant sleep machine, and because with the mattresses and the sheets and the pillows and the duvet, and you know, if you don't have a washing machine, you're not really interested in all that stuff, which can house fleas and lice. And many societies are worried about that because critters in your bed are not so good. So bedding tends to be minimal unless it's cold. I'll talk about that in a moment in terms of fires and what that means. But bedding tends to be minimal. And often comfort and warmth are achieved by sleeping with other people. So when you co-sleep, you share the warmth, and you also share the comfort of being with other people, because as long as they're okay, you're okay. So that was the third thing that was a huge insight that is so different from certainly how I grew up sleeping in the United States, which is you slept alone. I slept alone from infancy onward. My parents were proud to prepare a special bedroom for me, like many nesting parents do. And I was put down to sleep every night there, and I've slept alone until I partnered with my husband. And so this notion that actually sleeping alone is dangerous. So it's not only something you don't do very much, but it's actually dangerous, was completely new to me. And why is it dangerous? For a whole lot of reasons. But one is you're socially isolated. You don't have the comfort of others around you. It may signal that you're marginalized in some way. So many societies work hard to provide an age and gender appropriate sleeping partner. If the whole family doesn't sleep together, which they not uncommonly do. So I'll stop there, because there's plenty we could talk about.
Absolutely. Well, that kind of leads a little bit into my next question, which is in one of your articles, you also state that sleep arrangements map social identity and belonging. And mm-hmm. I just love that idea. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, about how relationships kind of within sleep kind of relate to each other?
Sure. So even though societies have different ideas about sleep, it doesn't mean they don't have any rules about sleep or moral issues. Virtually everywhere, sleep, it, like every other activity, is framed within a moral universe about what's good and not so good for your and society's well-being. And so very often it's age and gender that are important markers for with whom you should sleep. In a number of societies where co-sleeping is common, as kids hit puberty, say in New Guinea, for example, and parts of Amazonia, boys are sent off to separate sleeping houses, actually. You can imagine how rowdy it gets in there. I don't know how much sleep in it. And then girls may remain with their mother, often fathers in those segregated societies. Fathers will be sleeping separately, and the boys may join men in male sleeping huts, or they may have their own adolescent sleeping huts. So that's a very common phenomenon that kids who have been co-sleeping up to a certain age then are segregated out in this way. And what we observed in Egypt was in Cairo, in the urban setting, this was actually became a bit of an issue, because for boys and girls who did not, family sizes had shrunk. Apartments were small in Cairo and life was pretty dense. But there was a notion that you should provide an age and gender appropriate sleeping partner, but none was available. So you couldn't have boys and girls, you know, like 16-year-olds sleeping together, which meant that they would sleep separately. And you had boys and girls sleeping alone for the first times in their lives. And girls tended to ruminate and get depressed in some cases. And boys tended to get dysregulated because they played games all night and sneaked onto computers. So this is also hopefully to give you a sense that when we're talking about traditional societies, a place like Egypt has been living in cities for thousands of years and has their own sleep practices that are distinct from Western European sleeping practices.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I love the work you've done about how, you know, this idea of having to sleep separately affects adolescence, because mm-hmm. it is such a tumultuous time. And so much of in Western society thinks, well, you know, little kids should be sleeping alone. But and even then, you know, people will report, oh, my goodness, I was so scared of the dark when I was young. But you expect by the time you're an adolescent, oh, they'll be fine. But it doesn't sound like they were always fine. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I imagine that many of your listeners know that and have experienced the phase shift, the famous phase shift, puberty and adolescence, where the body clock shifts to wake you up later in the morning and keep you up later at night. Just as a sidebar, since I'm an anthropologist, we always like to ask why. Why might it be that way? And what's pretty cool about humans is that across our life cycle, we have shifts in sleeping patterns. So we all know about babies who are completely dysregulated, and it takes them several months, if not a little longer, to get their act together. And then children need a lot of sleep. They tend to fall asleep early and wake up bright and early. And then adolescents shift back later and stay up way late if they're given a chance. And then adults kind of are somewhere in the middle, and then elders tend to also start to fall asleep earlier, wake up a little earlier, but also wake up in the middle of the night. And some very cool work. So I'm happy to tell you that once we were able to draw anthropologists' attention to sleep, they're really jumping in there these days. And there's some very nice research coming out that's super exciting. And one, it was with a hunter-gatherer group in East Africa that showed with very fine-grained quantitative data that we love, that this pattern, even in a small group of about 20 to 25 people, this pattern of age difference and sleep meant that someone was awake, literally, virtually 99.999% of the time. Which, if you sleep in grass huts in the middle of the savannah in Africa, is a good thing.
Absolutely. There's quite a few dangers, I'm sure, at night that you want someone to be aware of, for sure. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about like different sleeping arrangements among people? I was really fascinated by one culture in particular, and I can't remember the name of it offhand. But it was a rather unequal, segregated type of society where the men stayed up long into the night, and but they would stay up and spend time in a central area, whereas the women and children had to go to sleep around the periphery and be quiet and leave them alone for, you know, 10 hours at a time. So to me, that, you know, that's kind of interesting because it kind of indicates that maybe there is some. The sleep patterns can sometimes reflect like the cultural values in terms of, you know, equality or inequality, or, you know, how much they value the different members of their society. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mary, how social values get reflected in sleep arrangements. The society you're thinking of is was a specific Highland New Guinea society that is representative of a number of these Highland, very highly sex segregated societies. It wasn't every night, I'm happy to tell you, where members sang up all night. These were special seance nights when they were communing with spirits and maybe doing divination or healing or a whole variety of social negotiation and spiritual oriented type things. And on the average, though, men would stay up later. They would smoke bong and drink and kind of hang out. And women and children went to sleep earlier out on the edges of that central space. Because most of the anthropologists who worked in those areas were men, and the ones I knew were men, they could tell me about what the men were doing, but they could say, you know, they had a hard time believing the women and children could sleep through all of this. They weren't entirely sure actually what they were doing during that time, which I think also is an interesting point in terms of how the social science sometimes reproduces these inequalities in terms of who do we talk to. This issue of gender plays out in many societies where women are the ones who get up at 4 a.m. pre-dawn in many cases. So this was from South America to Botswana to Bali, where the women are up early to start the fires, bring them back up, start the water cooking, or the first meal, the first tea, beverage, whatever it would be. And so you commonly had real gender differences in the sleep amount and timing. And this is really interesting because in the Western literature, women appear to consistently need more sleep, or at least they get more sleep. So the question there is, where you have fluidity in sleep practices, women get, and or people who need more sleep are able to do so because there isn't a bedtime. There isn't a sense of, you know, now you have to go to sleep, or you must stay up until a certain time. So I think that lack of notion of how much sleep you must get and when you must go to bed creates some space for taking the edge off some of these inequalities, or also labor issues that have some members of society needing more sleep or sleep at different times than other members.
And I think, in our society, because we are conditioned to do a one stretch of sleep and right. not sleep during the day, it sounds like perhaps, you know, you might be able to sometimes make up for the lack of sleep during at night by doing some sleeping during the day in societies where things are a little more fluid. Does that make sense? Do you find that?
Yes. This is particularly true, of course, in societies where the climate is an important factor. So most people know about circum-Mediterranean patterns traditionally, where heat in the middle of the day had everyone taking siesta. And so you close down the shops, you leave the offices in these historically urban settings, right?
You found that in your Egyptian research as well.
Right, yeah. Exactly. That naps were routine even in this society that is hugely urbanized and where you have paid labor, people working in offices, but where there's a break in the middle of the day and people will take a nap.
Absolutely. So you also cover a little bit about how animals often interact with humans during sleep in different cultures, both domesticated animals and predators. Can you mention a little bit about that as well? I think that's very interesting. For us, we always think about just a cat or a dog on our bed, but there's a whole nother type of domesticated animal that sometimes interacts with people in sleep. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And I'll just preface what I'm saying with my thought that Westerners sneak dogs in beds and dogs and cats into their bed because they don't have co-sleepers. But to give you an idea of how animals play a role around sleep for humans, in some societies where it's very cold, and this includes in part historically in parts of Eastern Europe, or Switzerland, Germany, and across Europe, you would sleep upstairs and have the animals downstairs because the animals create heat. And so it's a nice little way to heat your floorboards, heat from below. You keep your animals safe because that's the other thing. At night, animals, your domesticated animals, are vulnerable to predators. And so you want to keep them nearby and safe. And in fact, in one group of camel herders, camel and cattle herders in northern Kenya, one ethnographer remarked that people regularly said that you knew there was a problem outdoors when the camels and cattle stopped chewing, when they became very still. So animals were like early warning. Of course, dogs and humans' long history of living with dogs. Again, dogs barking in the night, that's a big deal. It's a big reason to have dogs around. I can attest, they can drive me nuts in the field. People are all happy. It's like, oh yeah, the dogs were really singing last night. And I'm like, oh yeah, I got 2 hours of sleep thanks to them. But so people are habituated in a different way that background noise can provide information. And we know from the neuroscience that actually there is this kind of subliminal processing, as many parents know, where you actually are attending to that for that moment, a little cry from your baby or some sound from a child that will indicate that something's up and you pop out of sleep. So that's one area. Is we think of the domesticated animals, we think of the predators, and we also had an example from South America of foragers who were literally stalked by a panther for a number of days. Someone was killed in the night. And so night can be a dangerous time when fire and vigilance and staying together is absolutely essential. But then the last thing I'll mention is something that we're also privileged not to deal with, and that's parasites and fleas and lice and ticks. That are a huge issue, and I've already mentioned that vis-a-vis bedding. People who are plagued by, say, intestinal parasites, I'll spare you the gory details. It's just they can be more active at night than other times. Animals and mosquitoes are a major predator that as vectors of not just malaria, but a host of other ailments, is a reason that people have fires and maintain them even when it's warm, because the smoke from the fire acts as a fumigant. And so I've got some lovely pictures, and probably some of you have seen pictures of those grass huts in some forest in Central Africa with smoke coming up through the grass. And it looks kind of ghostly, but actually what it is this giant fumigation system that keeps both the spiders in the grass and all the other critters you don't want to think about, along with the mosquitoes, at bay.
And I think you even mentioned that some societies might even use incense, that smoke could be used sometimes to keep some parasites at bay as well.
Mm-hmm. So. That smells good. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, of course, we wonder, you know, is that going to be a problem in terms of the air quality and people breathing in the smoke? But on the other hand, you know, which is worse, the parasites or the respiratory issues?
This is great. I'm so glad you brought this up because I work a lot with World Health Organization, and that has been a huge campaign on their part to deal with smoky cooking fires and the differential exposure of women and sometimes children to the smoky cooking fires and how bad that is for lung health in particular. And part of the reason why we can afford to try to reduce smoky cooking fires is that we're also changing housing patterns so that you have fixed walls and tin roofs, which have their ups and downs too, but better ways to keep the vermin out.
Absolutely. You know, you mentioned about the predators, you know, some societies, obviously, if you have a very flimsy, I mean, it's just what it is, but, you know, a grass hut or some leaves as a shelter, then you have to be very careful that someone's always awake, tending the fire to keep predators away. But you also, I think, mentioned that there's certain societies that even if they have very solid walls and very, you know, sealed kinds of living quarters, they will go ahead and shut down their living quarters because nighttime is a time of, you know, bad spirits, and they want to keep out, you know, the, you know, spirits that might harm them, you know, spiritually or, you know, ghosts or whatever it is. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Sure. And people have spent, you know, these beliefs also were prevalent in Southern Europe, most famously in Italy, that's been studied, the idea of bad air that can come around in the night. And it could be related to mosquitoes, that it's real, that, you know, mosquitoes come around, and if you're not closed up, you are feeling worse in the morning. Anyway, in many societies, there's a belief that the night is a special time for the mind and the spirit. And so what's going on when you're asleep? Well, one of the things that may be going on is that your mind travels, or other minds come to you, or both. And so this can be a positive, and dreams reinforce this, right? Because we have experiences at night we don't have, we have experiences in sleep that we don't have at any other time. And so it's a valid question. Where did those experiences come from? Why did I dream about Uncle Fred, under the bridge shouting some inarticulate words? Was he trying to get something across to me? These sorts of things. And so many societies pay attention to dreams, share dreams in the morning and talk about them, try to interpret what they might mean. And your question in terms of spirits that may come to you, this is another reason to sleep with other people. People anchor you to the world of the living. And we also know that many illnesses tend to have crises at night. So this makes sense that there is the idea that if there aren't other people around, the spirits may come and take you away, and there's no one to anchor you or bring you back or save you. And so that reinforces the value of co-sleeping. And on the other side, in some societies, you try to have a spirit dream where you connect with special spirits. So I don't want to give the idea that all dreams and all spirits are thought to be scary. Dreams may be revelatory. And so Tibetan Buddhists, for example, particularly the monastics, have elaborate notions about sleep yoga and revelations that you might have during that time.
So that brings up another interesting point, and that is about like social events and rituals that might take place at night. And, you know, maybe move bedtime. I mean, there's not really a bedtime, but move that back or move it later on into the night. And can you talk about how common that kind of thing is and maybe give some examples of those sort of rituals that might happen in, you know, nighttime settings?
Yeah. Well, I need to frame this a tiny bit with an unusual aspect of human sleep, which is compared to other primates, including our nearest relatives, the great apes, we are active after dark. So humans have uniquely colonized the night. So we sleep less than our primate relatives. And there are some other special features of sleep architecture that humans have. But this means that as hunter-gatherers, where we go out during the day and we gather food, the big deal with humans is we bring it back. We don't eat it on the spot. We bring it back and we actually share it, which is very special. And anthropologists have made a big deal out of this, studied it hugely. What they hadn't noticed so much is that, that this is a time for social negotiation as well and sharing of information, not only sharing information about where you found that peccary or where the fruit is, right, but also negotiating marriages, conflicts, ideas, all kinds of social stuff goes on at night. And in fact, our bodies tend to have that a second kick starting around 6 o'clock up to about 9 o'clock, where our attentional systems are up again. We have a late afternoon kind of, and then in the evening, we kind of rev up. Probably a lot of you would recognize that pattern. So that means that in many societies, night is a big time anyway to do social stuff. And people will stay up if the gossip is good or the marriage negotiation is going hot and heavy. Then you'll stay up and you make up for, you don't have to clock in tomorrow. So you make up tomorrow for that sleep time that you just lost. So there's more fluidity there. That's one. But then the other is you're right that some particular rituals, sometimes these are rituals of initiation. We could talk about that, where you're trying to bring new members of society on board and bringing them up to speed to be adult, responsible adults. But then others are related to spiritual issues. And so we could think of Ramadan, which was just over, and where you abstain from food and drink all day and nighttime, whew, at last you can eat, drink, and party and celebrate Ramadan. And that goes on for a whole month. So I'm sure we all have some Muslim friends where we see that shift in activity patterns and what it does. But another one, for example, is in Bali. Many of you may be familiar with the famous shadow puppet plays. And you've seen the beautiful shadow puppets. Well, think about it. Shadow puppets mean it must be going on at night. That means that people are staying up to watch these big epic shows about the Ramayana and the other epics that tell a whole variety of tales about what it is to be human, and morality tales about good and bad. Fantastic music, great sound effects, great light and graphics. So wonderful displays that go on for long periods of time and are orchestrated generally by elders who like to complain to each other about how sleep deprived they are because they're so busy organizing these things.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we think, oh, well, you know, years ago, you know, everybody just went to sleep when the sun went down and got up when the sun came up. And that's not true at all. No. But, you know, I think one thing that is different about our, you know, many Western societies is artificial light, because in traditional places, you might be socializing, having talks about things, rituals, whatever. But the lights were fairly low, so when it was time to kind of wind down for sleep, you could go to sleep, and that's probably how people could just kind of drop off here and there where whenever they wanted to. That makes absolute sense that they, this is the time where you can relax and actually socialize. You don't have to be working like you would during the day. Can you talk a little bit about how sometimes sleep deprivation actually might be used in perhaps like initiation rituals in adolescence, that kind of thing?
A number of initiation rituals, but it may be also some of these spiritual events, even like Ramadan, are reminding people of their frailty, of the importance of spiritual things, that the body is weak, Anyway, reminders of mortality that may be important messages. But I think what you're talking about then are deliberate, usually this is targeted boys. Mm-hmm. Girls may be sequestered to menstrual huts or may have more brief periods of initiation, but the big elaborate heavy sleep deprivation, sometimes physical punishment, I don't know, anyway, harsh treatment, I guess would be the way to put it, beatings with nettles or things like that, are used to get young people to get with the program. It's sort of like, okay, you had a nice childhood, that's great, but now you got to step up and be a member of society. And obviously this can have to do with power as well, right? We have this in American prison systems where sleep deprivation or it can be used as a form of torture. Controlling sleep, the power to control sleep can definitely be a way to let the other person know who's boss. In the case of these more benign initiation rituals, the idea is really to get kids to realize that being adult is important and they are going to be important and valuable, and they need to pay attention because they're going to be crucial members of society and they need to get some basic home truths about how things work. And how things work, at least the most heavily documented of these cycles, we don't have as much, unfortunately, in North America, where there were spirit quests and really interesting stuff going on. There was some documentation in the 19th century, but these societies were fragmented too early and too systematically to know as much as we'd like. In the case of New Guinea, heavy documentation that you have young people learning, being instructed, being asked to perform certain skillful tasks. And so sleep deprivation may be used in those contexts as a way to kind of help change people's minds. In the same way you might say of some forms of torture, I don't want to get too close to this here, but that the nighttime seances that we talked about earlier, where men were in the middle and they were smoking and drinking and trying to evoke spirits, inducing altered states of consciousness, where the idea is to shift to have new kinds of understanding and insight.
You know, it's interesting too, because it's almost like there's a belief in childhood that you can't control sleep. You just sleep when you need to, when you want to. But as you become an adult, you need to be able to pay attention and stay awake. And I love an example you have in one of your articles about how it's just if men in I don't remember the society, but if you happen to fall asleep during their social gathering or whatever, they will dress up in like warlike clothes with a weapon and threaten, you know, wake the person up and threaten them so that they think they're going to be about to be attacked. And if the man like jumps back and is horrified and thinks he's about to die, they just think that's hilarious. You know, it's such a wonderful joke that they played on this person, but it kind of teaches them a lesson too. Like, don't fall asleep in the middle of my story.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I love that. So, could you also talk a little bit about how sleep changes during the lifestyle? Can you expand upon that? You know, how sleep changes from infancy to childhood to adolescence, and to, you talked a little bit about how, you know, our cycles tend to shift as we change ages, but what is like expected of, I mean, are children just expected to sleep wherever, but then people are need to be able to stay awake certain times as they get older? Is there expectations like that in certain cultures?
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah, well, one of the things we haven't mentioned is that sleep, we tend to think about sleep being really important for body repair, and that is a role of sleep. But the biggest deal about sleep is by the brain, for the brain. Because we have this huge, busy brain. That's the big deal that we like to congratulate ourselves on. But it's a needy and some ways fragile organ that heavily needs maintenance. And this is where sleep plays a huge role. And the development of the brain across the life course then is a sort of underlying feature that we can think about in terms of how that relates to sleep, and then how our sleep practices may play nicely with the brain or push against it sometimes. And so one of the big things that's happening in infancy is that, you know, the fetus has been in mom who's been doing all the chronobiology, running all day, every day sort of thing. And so when the baby is born, that's the first like, oh my gosh, I have to breathe, I have to see, and I have to start living in this circadian world. And it has been circadian in that mothers had sleep-wake cycles, but babies now have to do it themselves. No more mom doing it for them, although lots of moms and dads would say they are, because parents play a huge role in help. Babies are incredibly helpless. They're not as helpless as we like to think, but they really need that attention, care, protection, feeding, thermoregulation, all the stuff, while the nervous system and especially the brain is developing like crazy. And so it's that developing brain that allows the baby to be able to start sleeping through the night, start getting with the waking, sleeping, feeding routines that then really continue to develop over the first 2 years, and then continue into adolescence, because adolescence, we talked about that shift, but adolescence is another period, a special period of brain development where there's some final rewiring that gets done. It's a really cool time. So that's led folks to speculate whether these traditional practices for initiation and so forth are trying to like take advantage of these teachable moments. And likewise in our schools and other rituals that we put kids through, you know, we may be doing same thing. Mm-hmm. But the thing I want to highlight here is one of the things that the brain and body are learning to do is to state regulate. That is, stay awake, not fall apart, be able to pay attention, do what you need to do. And we're in this incredibly social world, so we have to pay attention to other people. It's dynamic, a lot of stuff going on all the time. And so being able to tell the difference between what's important and what's not important is a huge part of what our brain learns and continues to learn across our lives. And so many of us, you know, part of my training is in neuroscience. Those of us who are really interested what the brain is doing across the life groups are very keen to understand how sleep practices may shape these attentional regulatory systems, and to what extent do certain practices strengthen our capacity for state regulation, and what might erode them and make us vulnerable to sleep dysregulation. So I'll end that thought with the point that if we put those babies to sleep by themselves, as I was as a kid, I don't remember being traumatized, being fine, but if we put our kids to sleep and they must stay regulated through the night, one way or another, there isn't a lot of help there unless parents come, but you've got to do it on your own. Are we stressing these systems in a way that makes them, maybe not everybody, because I have no problem with sleep and seem to be pretty good with state regulation. So a bunch of folks seem able to tolerate that. It's within the realm of human plasticity. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a hefty chunk of folks for whom this is not so good. Mm-hmm. And where there may be both issues in sleep and then potentially in mental health, attention regulation, that lead to vulnerabilities later in life, including in aging. Maintaining mental capacities into old age, that's a sort of new area that as the world ages, we're more and more interested in understanding.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I really feel that in a lot of traditional societies, babies, infants, are co-regulated by their parents or another adult. They're carried. And I like to say that in most places around the world, babies don't sleep lying down. They sleep vertically while they're being held by somebody or carried by someone. And I think you made that point in one of your articles that pretty much all adults and older children sleep lying down, but infants don't. They sleep, you know, wherever they are on a person. And I wonder sometimes, is that person kind of regulating them with their breathing and their movements and all of that kind of thing, because they don't have the capacity to self-regulate in many cases at first. Is that your understanding, is that most babies basically during the day, at least, they nap like on someone somewhere being carried or being held? Is that what you have discovered in general?
In many, many cases, yes. So especially with mobile hunter-gatherer societies and herding societies to a lesser extent, yes, because both for safety and for convenience, you have the infant on your body. And that's, if we're talking about gender, that's, some people have documented that this is actually part of a gender distinction in foraging patterns, because if mom is carrying an infant all the time, she can't be as fast or as efficient as a guy who's not breastfeeding and carrying that child. But if we're thinking about, sorry, I'm going to have to back up a moment.
That's
okay. We were talking. I started to go off on a tangent. The question was?
Well, the question's more about like, how do you think that an infant's state is regulated more by, and it's not just always on mom. It could be another child, a grandparent, someone, you know, that is holding that child or carrying that child and helping them regulate their sleep state.
Yeah. Yeah, and actually, very much so. A pediatric developmental pediatrician, Ron Barr, showed this a number of years ago, along with Mel Connor, working with comb hunter-gatherers, that the carrying the infant dramatically reduced the hours of crying. So comb infants fussed just the same amount as Canadian parents did. So they compared Canadian and home parents, and the the cone would fuss just as much, but mom was right there and would immediately respond, jiggle, feed, vocalize, do something. Whereas if the infant was alone in Canada, like they'd have to make more of a fuss. So what Ron Barr did was an intervention, actually, where he asked parents to carry their infants as much more as they could. He didn't tell them how much. And I think it was just about 45 minutes more a day. And this dramatically reduced the amount of infant crying. Because basically, babies are signaling. They can't talk. So they're signaling that they need something. And if they can be confident that their needs are being attended to, they don't have to signal so much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I sometimes say to my clients, you know, that the babies that complain or that signal more, they are the babies that would have been more likely to survive. Yes. If the babies that were put down and were quiet, they could have been easily eaten, whereas the babies that were fussing, they would be picked up and be safe. And so sometimes it's that helps parents to understand why, oh yeah, my baby's not a bad child, a fussy child. My child is very well adapted for this world. And so I think it helps to think about it that way, especially when it's
a bit. If I can reinforce that with an anecdote, Nancy Nicholson was an anthropologist who was working with Maasai in Tanzania, and her husband is a psychiatrist, and he came along just because he was interested and hung around, and he did some small observations of mothers and infants and did notice that there were big differences among infants. Some infants were nice and peaceful and they barely fussed and no problem. And other infants were just a pain in the neck, especially boys, he said, that they, so he did some systematic work on this, but they came back 3 years later and there had been a terrible drought. And it was the fussers who were more likely to have survived than the little peaceful ones.
Yeah. They demand to being taken care of. They're not content just to be left alone and not be taken care of. So absolutely. So I want to talk about one other thing, and that is this, you know, as you mentioned, there's a, you know, desire in many cases to put an infant and not just infants, but families, parents, children, everyone feels like they need to sleep in a very quiet environment, dark, quiet, comfortable environment. This is like really important to get a good night's sleep. And yet that's not at all how things are done in many societies. So I want to read a quote from you because I just think it's fascinating and it could be connected to some things that we deal with in our society. So this is what I found just amazing. Put simply, American parents put their infants to sleep under conditions of minimal sensory load, but later expect their children to titrate arousal and focus attention appropriately in a world with high sensory loads and heavy competing demands for attention. Second, early sleep practices may lead to increased difficulty in affecting desired and appropriate state transitions, as in falling asleep, waking, concentrating, or relaxing. Thus, sleep practices and ecologies may contribute to risk for sleep disorder, as well as to other difficulties of state regulation, as in mood or learning disorder. So my question for you is, do you think that our emphasis on like quiet, solitary sleep might be contribute to our difficulty in concentrating in school or work, or, you know, issues being able to, you know, state regulate in, you know, more distracting environments?
Yeah. Yeah, this is still a huge question. I have to tell you, to me, this is an empirical question. We haven't done these kinds of studies because we haven't really questioned our model of sleep. It's understandable that because sleep research has been done by Western science, that we would use our Western model of sleep as the model of sleep. And we have done a lot about the development of state regulation and sleep, et cetera. But in terms of trying to answer empirically that question that you just posed, I'm going to say we don't really have answers. And I think it's important to say that because there are some areas where we can speculate, or we see the patterns are so stark that I can say something like, wow, look, we sleep in a sensorily deprived setting. And that's really different. But I think it's not right, or it would be premature to say I know what that means. I would really like, we have so much wonderful neuroscience and developmental neuroscience going on. I'm really hoping that some of these areas of sleep ecology that I can tell you sleep science has really started to pay attention to and ask questions, for example, about whether health inequalities are actually driven by inequalities in sleep. Because we know that, at least in the United States, disadvantaged groups and, for example, African Americans living in poverty and poor housing have fewer and less and more fragmented sleep because of the conditions that they sleep under. And so anyway, the research is ongoing to ask the question whether the conditions under which we sleep from childhood onward really make a difference for mental and physical health, and therefore whether we can do some preventive interventions to give people better ideas of what they should aspire to or work toward, rather than feeling bad if they don't get their 8 hours of sleep in a perfectly quiet room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a wonderful takeaway. That, you know, people around the world sleep in very sensory rich environments, you know, the dog barking and the, you know, cows mooing and, you know, the street traffic in Cairo and all of that sort of thing. And so that, you know, it's very possible for you to, you know, to be able to sleep that way. So I tell people that, you know, when you have an infant, if you train them or that's the only way they know how to sleep is in a very quiet, dark location, it might be more difficult for you later on for them to be able to sleep in other more convenient places. Like if you need to go somewhere, you might want them to sleep, another. So I feel like, you know, because just knowing that we don't have to have this very quiet, dark setting to sleep can be very helpful for people, because then if they are able to just go about their day, let their infant sleep wherever, it can be a much easier way for that child. You don't always have to have the perfect sleep setting in which for them to fall asleep. So I think that's an important factor that will help parents feel a little bit better about not always having the perfect sleep environment for their infants.
Absolutely. And it may actually be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. In fact, yeah, I mean, I think Dr. McKenna has talked about how that quiet, dark, you know, sometimes is actually not good because the child needs noises in order to arouse and not sleep too deeply. So we don't want them to stop breathing because they're sleeping too deeply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. So this has just been so fascinating, Dr. Werthmann. I'm really pleased that you took the time. Do you want to mention some of the other areas of anthropology that you've studied and tell folks where they could find more about your work? I would love to hear a little bit more about that.
Well, thank you for asking. I guess I'll share the work I'm doing right now because it's foremost in my mind. And that is working on global mental health issues, finding we have a commission and fact-finding and policy agenda setting process that we've undertaken to try to understand the key factors that are sources of early mortality related to mental distress and suicide, because these have emerged as big issues during COVID, but also we're confronting climate change. And so I think as an anthropologist, I feel as though I've had the privilege of learning from such a wide array of humans across my life. It's time, though, to pay back as much as possible to take on the issues of the day and to find some common solutions and principles, but also areas of diversity and not common solutions and principles that we can deploy to help reduce human suffering. So that's what's occupying me.
Wonderful. Are there any just takeaways that you've gotten so far about maybe the value of community or anything like that that you found has made a difference in people feeling less isolated and feeling more mentally healthy?
Yeah, absolutely. And here it's been really interesting. With all the negative stuff about social media, and there is a bunch of not good stuff that's happening, for those who can feel positively connected through social media, for whom this is not a source of social poison, but rather of social support, that this has actually been beneficial. The work has been particularly among adolescents because there was so much concern, and actually showing that kids who have been struggling with social relationships before, who are able to have, often in gaming contexts, actually, where they feel part of a community and are sharing an activity that has meaning. One of the big things, the big take-home messages really is that I think everybody would say, duh, we all got the memo, that we need to de-siloize mental and physical health. It's one big package. And in fact, health, we have to de-siloize from our lives. Health is a product and a process of how we live. And so if we work on, you know, how we live, and integrate health into our ways of thinking about how we can live better on less as we try to reduce our footprint on this earth to have a long-term future, that seems to be an important theme, is de-siloizing and reconnecting and trying to float all boats, although not all boats are the same boats.
Right. Exactly. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. This has just been a fascinating discussion, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me. So thank you so very much. Again, this was an interview with Dr. Carol Werthmann from Emory University, and I am Mary Francell, IBCLC. Check out my blog at www.whatdobabiesneed.com. And Carol, can you tell us where folks can find more about you and about your work?
I'm not as facile as you are. I'm so old school that I mostly do publications and online stuff. But if you put my name, Carol Werthmann, anthropologist, just type that in, you'll find a whole bunch of stuff.
Absolutely.
And you can write to me. It's Werthmann, Werthmann, at Emory, Emory.edu. I'd love to hear from people.
That's excellent. Thank you so much for offering that. And we'll ask Emily to put that in the show notes as well. So again, okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mary.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.